And once again, it's time for another edition of Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, 91.3 FM in Olympia, Washington, 87.9 FM on Mojo Radio in Point Arena, California, 87.9 FM on Post World Radio in Seattle, Washington, and www.freakradio.org. My name is the V-Man, and today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll be discussing an altogether uncomfortable topic, childhood sexual abuse. My guest is Stacy Haynes, founder and executive director of Generation 5. Join us in just a moment. Stand by, stay tuned, Rockin' the Boat, coming up next. Child sexual abuse is an ugly subject no one wants to talk about. Well, on today's show, we'll talk openly about sexual abuse of children and the trauma it can cause. The exact incidence of child sexual abuse is unknown, but it's estimated that 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys will be sexually abused before the age of 18. 90% of these cases will never be reported. Problems for the child may include physical injuries, fear, depression, self-destructive behaviors, low self-esteem, feelings of confusion, sexual acting out behaviors, nightmares, hostility, phobias, antisocial behaviors, and socialization problems. Decades of research consistently document that adults who were sexually violated as children are also negatively impacted as a consequence of these abuses. The range of abuse-related difficulties in adulthood includes depression, anxiety, self-mutilation, low self-esteem, eating disorders, interpersonal difficulties, post-traumatic stress disorder, and multiple personality disorder. Unfortunately, sexual abuse of children harms not only those victimized, but also their immediate families and extended communities. Ultimately, we are all affected, directly or indirectly, by child sexual abuse. Joining me today to talk about the issue by telephone is Stacy Haynes, author of The Survivor's Guide to Sex, How to Have an Empowered Sex Life After Child Sexual Abuse. A sex educator and former manager of Good Vibrations, Stacy Haynes is a trained somatics practitioner specializing in healing from trauma and sexual abuse. She is also the founder and executive director of Generation 5, a nonprofit organization that brings together diverse community leaders working to end childhood sexual abuse within 5 generations. Stacy Haynes, thanks for being with us tonight on Rockin' the Boat.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Let's begin by kind of identifying the problem and then move into what you view as some solutions and you know, preventative, a discussion about preventing childhood sexual abuse, because ultimately I think that's what we would all like to see this not happen. But tell us a little bit about your experiences with incest, and as much or as little of your personal story as you feel comfortable sharing with our listeners.
Great, good, thank you. So I am a survivor of child sexual abuse, and that happened within my family. I have 2 sisters, and all of us have, are survivors. And I think in, people survive in a lot of different ways, and in the list of things that you read, I think lots of folks can relate to that. And then a lot of other folks who have experiences of child sexual abuse just kind of relate to what it takes to survive. Mm-hmm. And, in my own background, I was one of the kids who kind of survived by doing everything I could to be strong, be independent, get good grades, kind of the over-functioning or overachiever end of survivors. And I think sometimes we don't think of folks on that end, but oftentimes, people survive by going to one extreme or the other, and I was at that extreme. But when I finally started realizing that I needed to deal with this or my whole life would get off track in a really big way, I was in my early 20s. And fortunately, I was also in a fairly political setting, which really helped me. And it helped me see that this issue wasn't just personal and about my life or happened because of who I was, but it really helped me see that it's something that happened to lots and lots of people, that I wasn't alone in it. and that in many ways that it wasn't my fault that it happened to me. And I think that's one of the biggest things that survivors struggle with at some deep level, is thinking it's our fault. So for me, really getting the chance to heal while I was also looking at social change in different ways helped me kind of go, oh, wait a second, this is a social change issue too. This is a domestic violence issue, or this is a sexual assault issue connected to other kinds of social oppression. And that connection actually really helped me stay motivated to heal. Because when, you know, the days I couldn't heal for me, I was like, okay, I'm going to heal because it's going to help some other people down the line. So, you know, that was motivating through the hard times. There's some very, very challenging times and really taking on healing from incest and from abuse.
When you decided to seek recovery in your own life, did you find that there was not a lot of resources available for childhood sexual abuse survivors?
No, there were hardly any resources, and sadly, in many ways, that's still the case unless you can afford kind of personal private therapy, which at the time I couldn't. What I did, I was in going to college. I kind of went to the psychological services department and said, look, I'm dealing with this. Do you have a group, or do you have someone who knows about this issue? And basically what they told me, they said, well, if you go out and organize a group of child sexual abuse survivors who want to have a group, we'll facilitate it, but none of us know that much about it. So I literally, kind of my first act in trying to get myself help, is I had to go out onto campus and organize and get enough people who wanted to come forward that then psych services would offer a group that then was free to all of us. So, you know, that was really my first experience in getting into healing. And then after that, it was, you know, just piece by piece making my way through into finding therapy. And then eventually, like you said in my intro, finding somatic work, which is really an approach to healing that includes body, mind, and spirit. Because I think a lot of survivors know this intuitively. A lot of the trauma gets really lodged in our bodies. And while we might think differently about it or even have emotions about it, a lot of those big reactions or trauma kind of reactions really just land in the body and stay there until they get worked out.
I'd like to hear more about somatic techniques that are used in recovery, and this idea that, you know, memories and trauma is stored in the body cells. How does the human body respond? You kind of touched a little bit upon it, but what are some of the methods used in the somatic practice?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just give you a little background, because I think folks can relate to this. You know, all of us have pretty automatic reactions when we're scared or startled or shocked. You know, like we hold our breath and kind of all this adrenaline starts running through the body and people get very alert, like, uh-oh, is something happening? And there's lots of ways that the brain and body respond automatically to trauma. And then once that happens enough, the body keeps reacting or responding like that even when trauma isn't happening anymore. So, you know, we'll look at flashbacks, or people will talk about having anxiety attacks, stuff like that. Some of the techniques that are used are really techniques that come out of either martial arts, like Aikido is some of the stuff that I've been trained in, and also hands-on work. And this isn't massage. It's much more working with where the body has held or stored trauma and getting to process that out, maybe more through something that looks more like acupressure. There's also some somatic techniques that really just ask people to, instead of talking about the incident, to really focus on the sensations in the body of where it feels like that incident is caught, or the experience of trauma, again, is kind of stored, and then helping the body unwind or unpack that. And it ends up being really, really effective for people who have trauma. Like, folks heal a lot faster that way.
I've read a little bit about people having triggers, like if a person was under a street lamp and they were raped or molested, mm-hmm. That, you know, bright lights and sexual activity under bright lights will trigger memories. And mm-hmm. Can you talk more about some of those triggers and how somatics is used to get rid of that stuff?
Yeah, sure. Well, when you think about it, we're pretty smart at surviving. You know, like, in some ways, humans have been the most successful at surviving out of all animals. You know, we kind of have taken over the planet. But it's very much of a survival strategy that's kind of evolved in us and in our brains, that if there's a dangerous situation, we take in all the information about that dangerous situation and then try to never be in that situation again. What's tricky about sexual abuse is, sometimes what will happen is people will try to not get hurt by trying to avoid sex or avoid intimacy, because it kind of gets wired like that, like, uh-oh, that was dangerous, and let me try not to go there again. Mm-hmm. Again, how the a somatic approach would work with that is really working with the sensations or the automatic reaction that comes out of the body, and helping it process through. It's almost like, again, if you imagine how we react to a shock, like, you know, kind of take in our breath and we're scared and your eyes get big. It's like the body gets caught there and doesn't get to relax again. So somatics helps the body identify that, helps you kind of process it through by paying attention to the sensations, not necessarily the content of the experience. And then the body goes, ugh, and gets to let down, or the nervous system gets to let down again. So it's easier shown than talked about.
Interesting.
A really interesting thing, though, about this, and I won't talk about it too long, is there's lots of studying going on right now in neuropsychiatry about the impact of trauma on the brain and brain development. And what's really interesting is that the parts of the brain that get really, really triggered, where there's a lot of brain activity or neuronal activity during trauma, is the reptilian brain, right? So our back brain, the oldest part, and what's called the limbic system or the limbic brain, which is kind of the emotional center. And what tends to go offline or have very little neuronal activity is the neocortex, the front part of the brain, and also the speech center. So having conscious memories or being able to really talk about it, those things come much, much later in the healing process and don't really address all the trauma that got worked with in more of the emotional brain and then the reptilian brain. And somatics really addresses those two parts of the brain.
I've also heard that a lot of survivors say they don't have clear memories of the abuse. Mm-hmm. Is this technique something that can be used to bring about clearer understanding of what happened when you were maybe 6 or 5?
Yes, sometimes that's what happens for people, is when the, again, how the trauma's kind of caught below consciousness, when that starts to get addressed through the nervous system, often what happens is memories will pop up into a more conscious or coherent place in the brain, or more the front of the brain. That can happen. Other people will just have what are called body memories, mm-hmm. where the conscious picture of what happened won't be there, but the body will go through exactly the same reaction as it had while the person was being abused. So definitely that happens with somatic work. Yeah.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org, and this is Rockin' the Boat. My name's the V-Man, and my guest tonight is Stacey Haynes, founder and executive director of Generation 5. She's also the author of The Survivor's Guide to Sex, How to Have an Empowered Sex Life After Child Sexual Abuse. Stacey Haynes, I'd like to hear about the founding of Generation 5. How long has this organization been around, and what is some of the goals?
Great. I'm very happy to talk about that. Generation 5 started as an activist project about 7 years ago and then became an official nonprofit organization just 2.5 years ago. The mission of Generation 5 is to end the sexual abuse of kids within 5 generations. And why we set that out as our goal is we really wanted to not just serve people who've been hurt, or not just advocate for people, but really imagine what kind of culture and what kind of world do we need to live in where child sexual abuse doesn't happen. And we wanted to say, no, that's where we're going. We know it's going to take a while to get there, but let's start with that end point and kind of walk backwards from that goal and see what we have to do. And one of the things that I think is really important about the kind of the start of this work is we spent about a year holding having community meetings. We actually cold called about 700 people to talk with them about child sexual abuse, and then had about 350 of those people actually come to community meetings. At the meetings, what we asked is, you know, if in 100 years we are going to be able to end child sexual abuse, what would have to change and how would we do it? And we really looked to other social change movements as models. But through all of that community input, we got a very, very diverse view of what are the different things that need to be addressed to actually make this happen. And from there, we really formed our strategy and formed our programs, and that really helped inform our vision.
So you're not necessarily working directly with survivors and in terms of healing and providing resources, but rather an advocacy organization. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that is fair to say. So we don't do direct services, although lots of survivors, we work with lots of survivors. Right. But what we do is we train community members to become community leaders to be able to end child sexual abuse and take on this issue. So in we kind of have mapped out a 5-generation plan, and really the 2 goals for the first generation, which we kind of think of as the first 25 years, is to train and support diverse leadership who's ready to take this on as a public issue, right, not just a private issue, and then also basically come up with community-based solutions. So one of the things that's been very important in the movement, let's say since the 70s, is that there have been more and more people who've come forward about this as individuals, and therefore more and more people who are trained, especially in the mental health field, to deal with this. But what hasn't happened is that incest and child sexual abuse has been looked at very much as a personal mental health issue, or maybe a family mental health issue, but it hasn't been looked at as a public health issue or a social change issue. And, you know, given the numbers, like, you really did your research, I appreciate that for this show, but if we're looking at 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys, we're looking at, no, this is a public epidemic.
Yeah.
And we want to approach it as a public health issue, a social change issue, and not just an individual issue.
So how do you view then, if people are speaking out more about it, then it will become less uncomfortable for abusers?
Well, what we're really looking at, we have a framework that might be that's kind of new in the field. First of all, what we're trying to do is, out of all those community meetings we held, what we heard over and over again is, I think child sexual abuse is awful, but I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
So really, very few people know how to have a conversation about it. Like, if they're concerned someone's getting abused or they're concerned someone is an offender, very few people know how to go up and say, look, I need to talk to you about this, and now I want to make a difference about this. So what we're really doing is kind of building community skills or community capacity to do something about it. We're really answering that question, what do I do about it? The other piece, since you mentioned offenders, as we look toward a solution to child sexual abuse, we also see that we need to be thinking very, very clearly about who are offenders, why do they offend, and how does offending get interrupted and treated? Mm-hmm. Because on some level, if offenders quit offending, we wouldn't have child sexual abuse anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at social change, and even in our program, we really include information about offenders. And last year in our leadership program, which I can tell you more about, we had 2 prior child sexual offenders come in and talk to our community leaders about those questions. Why did they do it? What could have stopped them? What could have prevented them in the first place? And how can we, you know, as community organizers or people who are committed to change on this, how can we interrupt or prevent offenders?
So once somebody is identified as a perpetrator or offender, what then happens? I mean, do you advocate maybe prison time or removing these people from children, from society for a time period? I mean,
mm-hmm.
what can be done to intervene?
Well, it's a great question, and that's a lot of the question that we're answering right now. Legally, here's what's tricky. Legally, what's set up is that if someone comes forward that they're a child sexual offender or is turned over as an offender, they go right into the criminal justice system. Now, the criminal justice system is pretty tricky in how they address this.
Mm-hmm.
The statistics are kind of strange. You know, most people, 90% of people who are sexually abused know the person who abuses them. The stranger molests that we hear about in most media, mainstream media, are a very, very small percentage of child sexual abuse. But when you look at the criminal justice system, who gets put through the criminal justice system and kind of given prison time mostly are stranger molests.
Mm-hmm.
So the statistics are, if this makes sense, that the closer an offender is in blood relationship to the victim, the less likely they are to go through the criminal justice system because of how the system's set up right now. So what we're really looking at is a lot of folks either know about child sexual abuse either in their families or kind of their extended networks, but because they know the person, they don't want to turn him into the criminal justice system. So we're looking at kind of what we're calling alternative justice approaches, where offenders absolutely get called out to be accountable, but there's choices about how that happens. Like right now, there are some volunteer offender treatment programs where an offender could come forward and start treatment without necessarily going through criminal justice first. Or there's some models, actually there's a great model in Ohio where what happens is it's kind of a wraparound where the offender gets called out, they do community service, they do some prison time, but if they're the main breadwinner for their family, they're also allowed to work so that family doesn't have to go on to, you know, be really economically strained. And then who gets services is the offender, the victim survivor, and also the other bystanders or other family members that were involved. So they have a good model that we're looking at. But some alternative justice approaches are necessary because most people don't want to turn somebody over to the cops that they know. Yeah.
So I see a big problem there.
Exactly.
In terms of people, you know, particularly family members, as you pointed out, the breadwinner oftentimes is the abuser.
Right.
And so there's a big reluctance to turn this person into the criminal justice system. We're kind of coming close to the end here. Yep. And so I wanted to hear more about the community response project of Generation 5. Tell me what this is, the logistics of it, when it's going to be happening.
Great, thank you. So the community response project is really our extensive leadership training. And it's a program. Folks come together and meet 7 times over the course of a year. And in that process, they get trained about child sexual abuse. They get trained about the dynamics of offenders. They get trained in community organizing skills. And then also the group goes into teams, and each team takes on a community project. And we have those community projects kind of organized beforehand. One of the ones we're doing this year is a project about having more men involved in this movement. So it's a male outreach and education project. Another one that we're doing is a neighborhood project where we're literally doing a door-to-door education campaign in a neighborhood supported by a number of the community organizations in that neighborhood. So those are some of the, you know, once people are trained and really supported as community leaders, then they get to move into applying those skills to community projects. We're doing this in the San Francisco Bay Area. It launches in November, so just in about 7 weeks. And then we're also launching one in New York City in February. And part of our vision is that we'll run these projects in different locations across the country to really help build a movement with diverse leaders who are well-informed to make change. So that's what our community response project is.
That's great.
Yeah.
And if listeners want to get more information about Generation 5 or order your book, The Survivor's Guide to Sex, How to Have an Empowered Sex Life After Child Sexual Abuse, where can they get more information or how can they help?
Great. Well, first of all, if anyone is interested in actually coming through this training, we're still taking applications for the Bay Area. And in last year's training, we actually had 4 people from Santa Cruz come up to the training and participate. It's held in Oakland, but we had some commuters, so that was great. Folks can find us online. It's probably the easiest at www.generation5, and 5 is spelled out FIVE.org. There is a downloadable application there, or folks can also call us. We're based in San Francisco at 415-285-6658. But all that information's online. And then the easiest way to get my book is on one of your online ordering companies. It's on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And then you can also get more information about the book on the Generation 5 website as well.
Great. I've been speaking tonight with Stacey Haynes. She is the author of The Survivor's Guide to Sex, How to Have an Empowered Sex Life After Child Sexual Abuse, and executive director and founder of Generation 5 we've been talking about tonight. And I really appreciate you being with me tonight here on Rockin' the Boat, Stacey.
Yeah, Hines. Thank you. Thank you for doing this show, too. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
And before I end, I want to give listeners some contact information for a local group. The Survivors Healing Center is located in Santa Cruz at 2301 Mission Street, and it is a great resource for survivors of child sexual abuse, and it's one of a few places in the world that is dedicated to helping survivors and victims of child sexual abuse. Again, it's 2301 Mission Street. I don't have their number off the top of my head, but they are also online at survivorshealingcenter.org, survivorshealingcenter.org. And before I end the show tonight, I'm going to read a public service announcement. Incest. It's like screaming, but hearing no echo. Survivors of Incest Anonymous, a 12-step self-help recovery program, can supply echoes. Survivors of Incest Anonymous provides support groups, literature, newsletters, pen pals, and speakers. There are no dues or fees, and Survivors of Incest Anonymous define incest very broadly to include any sexual encounter by a family member, an extended family member, or any adult that damaged the child. Recovery is difficult, but at least now, survivors can learn that they are no longer alone and not to blame. Healing is possible. In Santa Cruz County, Survivors of Incest Anonymous meets each week and is open to any childhood sexual abuse survivor. Survivors of Incest Anonymous meets Sunday nights from 7:30 until 9 p.m. in downtown Santa Cruz at the Walnut Avenue Women's Center, located at the corner of Walnut and Chestnut Streets. These meetings are all fragrance-free and open only to incest survivors and their supporters. For more information about Survivors of Incest Anonymous, call 831-477-4165. That's 831-477-4165. Or visit Survivors of Incest Anonymous on the World Wide Web at www.siawso.org. That's www.siawso.org. That's going to wrap it up for me tonight here on Rockin' the Boat. Join me again tomorrow from 5:30 to 6 o'clock right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org.